continuing with the media. The media's reporting of the riots in our cities, the burning and the destruction, again projected to America, the cataclysmic events that were taking place, and the dimension of the and the dimension and scope of the uprising in our country. I'm not at all sure, however, that in the presentation of the news that there was sufficient attention given to what were some of the causes for these outbreaks of violence and burning and destruction. Possibly that's not the function of the media, but it is not, but obviously it is not enough for people just to know what has happened. It is imperative that they have some idea of why it happened. But the coverage of the college campus disturbances and the political events were of particular interest to me, I suppose, of particular interest to me, period. Of course, I have a personal interest in these matters because I visited many of these college campuses and experienced the heckling and the disturbances that were so characteristic of the times. And, of course, as a man in public life and a candidate for office in for the high office, the presidency, I likewise had a very personal involvement in what was taking personal involvement in the activities of the time and how these activities were being reported. I doubt that any man is so personally involved in situations such as these, speeches on a college campus, campaign activities of his own, is in any position to give an objective judgment. But let me be subjective for a while and tell it like I saw it and as it appeared to me. First of all, it is the duty of the media to report what they see, what it sees, what it hears, and even further, to seek out what is going on and attempt to bring to the reading, listening, and viewing public and a broad portrayal of American life, and of course in our times of things and developments that are happening throughout the entire world. This is a rich diet for the average consumer of news. It may be even too much. As a matter of fact, it may very well be that the threshold of our sensitivity to news has to be continuously, has to go through a continuous escalation. People tend to get accustomed to whatever they see time after time or hear from continuously. Therefore, the media undoubtedly had built into its very existence and system raising the threshold of the news coverage in order to attract the attention or command the attention of the reader, the listener, and the viewer. If violence is a normal picture, is the normal pattern of the day, and if it is projected time after time, then violence that isn't too violent becomes uninteresting and no longer has any attraction to it. Therefore, the media must search out that which is even more outrageously violent in order to bring command the attention. I'm sure that this happened not by premeditation or design, but by just the natural course of events. It wasn't enough just to report, for example, what transpired at a meeting on a college campus, what was needed to really bring attention was to find some element of disturbance and to build and to constantly project and portray that there was a revolution afoot, underway, or that there was a kind of revolution underway on the college campus. No one ever stopped to ask how many people are really involved. Is this a general feeling? Does the demonstration represent a majority point of view or even a significant minority? Or is this demonstration just the activities of a limited number of militant activists who have decided to command attention? Now, this does not mean that the militant activists may not have a good case or a good cause, but I do think it is important that we keep in mind just what the news was portraying and projecting. I recall in 1966 that I was privileged as Vice President of the United States to be a speaker at the 300th anniversary of Rutgers University. This was a magnificent occasion. It was almost like a great pageant. After all, Rutgers University is one of the great American institutions of higher learning. On this 300th anniversary, there were chancellors and presidents of universities from all over the world in attendance. As these distinguished scholars and administrators marched to the platform, it was a colorful sight of the unique and colorful caps and gowns from the great universities of Europe, Asia, Latin America, and the United States. There were prominent and brilliant scholars in attendance, several of whom addressed a huge audience of thousands, of many thousands of people. It was my privilege to speak briefly at that occasion, representing the government of the United States. But the news, the evening news, and the morning press carried very little about the activities that had taken place that day at Rutgers. What was featured in the news were a handful of protesters who were at least 600 yards away from the main event that was taking place. A handful who were protesting the war, protesting the university, and protesting almost anything that they could think of. These people were so insignificant at that particular occasion that they didn't even disrupt the proceedings. They could hardly be heard. There was a multitude of people there out of respect and affection for Rutgers. They had come from many parts of the world to pay their to participate in this 300th anniversary celebration. But the media, mesmerized by its own attention to disruption and demonstrations, concentrated its cameras and its press upon the handful of protesters. Yet there were other instances, of course, where the media brought to the attention of the American people events that were of such significance that they changed the course of history. Who can ever forget the media's portrayal of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., or the media's projection of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, or the media's projection of the poor people's encampment in Washington. These and other events did have a profound effect upon lawmakers, civic leaders, religious leaders, and the overall American community. So it's very hard, it's very difficult to be objectively critical when there is so much that is good intermingled with so much that would be less than worthy of honest journalism. I also recall another event which has both a message in it as well as a note of humor. I was asked to speak at the commencement exercises for Temple University in Philadelphia. I flew there in a Jetstar airplane, and prior to departure, I was called by one of the reporters of a network. He had missed his plane, and he needed to get to Philadelphia. I always had a good, friendly relationship with the reporters of both the press, radio of press, radio, and television, and generally liked the individual members, considered them my friends, or at least looked upon them in a spirit of warmth and friendship. But President Johnson had a firm rule, a strict rule, that I was not to take with me on any tour or trip in within the continental limits of the United States any reporter aboard a government plane. In other words, no reporters to travel with Vice President Humphrey. Well, on this occasion, I must confess that I violated that injunction. The reporter was really desperate. He had to be in Philadelphia. He had been ordered by his network to be there, and it might have meant his job had he missed it. So I said, get aboard, don't tell anybody, I'll get you there, and you leave me as quickly as you can, so that there's no indication of your presence with me. This he did. But he was kind enough to inform me why he was going to Philadelphia. He said, you know, I'm going there to cover your speech. And I said, told him, thanks. He said, really, though, I'm going there to cover what's going to be a massive demonstration against you. And I said, oh, tell me about it. He then went on to inform me that a number of the faculty and students were preparing to get up and walk out in the sometime during get up or we're preparing to get up and walk out in mass in the early part of my message. This was to protest the war, to protest the Johnson administration, and to be an embarrassment to me. I had gone through experiences like this before, so I was not terrified in any way. However, I was pleased to be notified. When I arrived in Philadelphia, I found that I was to speak in what is known as Convention Hall, the very same place that I spoke in 1948 at the Democratic National Convention. It was on that occasion that I delivered my civil rights message, and delivered my civil rights message, which resulted in the walkout of what are known as the Dixiecrats. So I gathered my thoughts and tried to figure out what could I do that would prevent this walkout, this embarrassment to me. How could I handle the situation? When I arrived, I noticed that there were a large number of cameras, and they were stationed strategically in the hall, some of them at exits, some of them close to the podium. The hall was, in other words, fully covered by the electronic media and the press. They were waiting for that moment when a substantial number of faculty and students would quietly arise and walk out of the hall in protest to the presence of the Vice President of the United States. So when I was introduced, I proceeded promptly to say as follows. The last time that I was in this convention hall was during the Democratic Convention of 1948. I was privileged to speak from this very podium. And I said then to a great audience that it was time for the Democratic Party to walk out of the shadows of states' rights and into the bright sunshine of human rights. And lo and behold, there were those in the Democratic Party who were so bigoted and so intolerant, who were so unwilling to listen, that they proceeded to get up and walk out before I'd even had a chance to present my full message. I'm grateful that I am now at a university function where reason and tolerance and good manners prevail. And why, despite, regardless of what I might say or what any other speaker might say, that scholars, professors, students, and college administrators, by training and background, and by training and background, are always prepared to stay and listen, because it is reason and understanding and tolerance which characterizes the educated man. It is bigotry and intolerance which characterizes the ignorant man. And thank God for the privilege of addressing an educated audience. At that particular moment, there was deathly silence in the auditorium. I could see a number of the faculty member and students who had gathered together in the front rows, looking at each other, wondering what to do. And there were the cameramen with their cameras focused upon me and upon the students and faculty, as just as sharpshooters would be focused upon a target. They were ready to pull the button, so to speak, waiting for the great event. And they waited, and the faculty and the students sat, fidgeted, twisted, and no one moved. And I proceeded on with my speech, with no one walking out and receiving what I would have to call a very friendly and respectable reception. Now, Norman, I'm just going to toss into this tape a few general observations which we can piece into the books here and there. Some of this will be anecdotal material. Some of it will just be to fortify what I've said. Earlier, I spoke about my reassignment during my vice presidency as the liaison officer with the local governmental officers, particularly with the mayors. I always liked the mayors. They were a delightful group. Of all the public officials I've ever known, none are more expressive, none are more freewheeling, none are more enthusiastic than the mayors. They can bring you more information about what's going on in the country than any pollster or any political analyst that you'll ever meet. After all, to the average citizen, the government that is closest to them is the one that means the most. And government needs to be related to people where they live. That's why I've always felt that while political scientists and specialists in American government may become involved in the discussion of the federal system and federal, state, local government, that for the citizen and the taxpayer, he doesn't differentiate. Government to him is just government officials and politicians. Taxes to him are not federal or state or local, they're just taxes. And this is why when you're in Congress, for example, you frequently get letters from people complaining about their property taxes. Many people do not know that the federal government does not levy property taxes. They just know that government levies taxes, and if the property taxes are going up, I write to your congressman, just as well as writing to your councilman or your governor or your legislator. I always felt that the way that you measured the effectiveness of government is how it affected the lives of people where they live. The federal government, for example, deals in broad general policy, and it deals, of course, in international matters. Much of the federal government's activity relates to the defense of our country, to our State Department and its diplomacy, to our international relations, to the international monetary system, to foreign trade, to balance of payments, to exports and imports. But these are items that do not really command the attention of Mr. and Mrs. America living out there in a rural township or in a village or a local community. They're more concerned about what's happening to zoning, what's happening to the welfare program, what's happening to their taxes, and what's happening with the police and the fire department. In fact, about 90% of all the government that affects people's lives is state and local government. And the federal government, therefore, has a special responsibility to help to strengthen or make more effective that state and local government, thereby being of help to the local citizenry. Well, when you meet with mayors and county commissioners and city councilmen and the local government officials, you get this kind of solid, down-to-earth information. I've always kept up my contacts with them because I learn more in one session at a conference of mayors or the League of Cities than I've learned and I could learn in a month of study in Washington, D.C. And during the time that I served as vice president, I sought to bring back to the cabinet, to the president and his cabinet, these intimate details and stories of what was going on in the great cities of America and in the rural countrysides. My work with the county officials and with the National League of Cities and the U.S. Conference of Mayors gave me a special insight into these local problems. I made it my business to be the personal representative of these local officials in the federal governmental structure. And during the time that I was vice president, I was able to conducted a number of seminars and study sessions for the mayors and other local officials. I would call to Washington, D.C., the mayors and the other local officials to meet with members of the cabinet. I would insist that the cabinet officers remain at the meetings to answer the questions in a face-to-face manner. President Johnson supported me in this effort. The local government officials were, in other words, given direct, were privileged to have direct communication with the cabinet officers who had responsibility for a particular program. I made it my business to travel to state legislatures and to speak to those legislative bodies and their legislative leaders about the new federal programs. One of the shortcomings today in government or in our federal system is the failure of the federal officials to properly convey the full meaning of the new federal programs to the state and local government people. There is a lack of communication, a lack of understanding. And this can only come when people meet together and talk together. It does not come out of pamphlets and bulletins and rules and regulations. Some of the most effective work that I've ever been able to do in government was when we brought together the top federal government officials with the local administrators and local governmental officers. These were exciting sessions. I can remember one in Washington, for example, where one mayor got up and said he'd been trying to return some money to the federal government and he'd not been able to get anybody that would accept it. That he'd been trying for 2 years and every time he wrote in, somebody would always write back and say, this is the wrong place. At that particular moment, I got a hold of the mayor, brought him up to the platform, reached out and grabbed the hand of the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Mr. Wilbur Cohen at the time, and said, now here's your man. If you've got the check, present it to him. He'll see that it gets to the Treasury. It was little human interest stories like this that livened the whole, that added enrichment and life to the processes of government. Government tends to be formalized. It becomes institutionalized, and therefore it loses much of its meaning. One of the things that a vice president can do for his country and in any administration is to be the living embodiment of the federal government and its programs in contact with state and local government officers. Vice presidents should be, in a sense, educators. They should be the communication officer for the federal structure, for the federal government. Local people need to feel that they have a representative in the cabinet, and that one man who is more than any other cabinet official by protocol and status, since he is elected, is the Vice President of the United States. Mayors and local government officials know they can't always see the president, but a vice president should have and does have time, if he will but make it and take it, to give them the kind of personal contact and representation that the local government officials, local governmental officials need. This I tried to do, and I found it to be one of the most exciting and challenging experiences of my life. I likewise traveled to many sections of the country to conduct seminars, traveling to places like Indian reservations to explain the new program, the War on Poverty. In fact, this is one of the first assignments that I had as Vice President of the United States. Going to cities and opening up Head Start programs and explaining to the local sponsors all of the legislation relating to our educational system. I was privileged to visit with the planning officers of state and local government, trying to bring to them how the federal and state governments must learn to plan together, that it is a waste of resources and valuable waste of talent and time for us to travel separate paths. All of these meetings help bring, I think, renewed trust and confidence in government, because that trust and confidence is not the product of an official edict or bulletin, but rather of the human relations that takes place. As Vice President, I also brought to the White House the local government officials to meet with the President and to meet with the President. Mayors, county commissioners, state legislators are all too often bypassed. Washington is a long ways away from most of the cities. And when the mayors come to Washington, I believe they ought to have the opportunity of meeting with their president. When the county commissioners come, they should have that opportunity. It's good for the president, and it's good for them, and it's good for the local officials. As Vice President of the United States, as Vice President, I made this my business. Sometimes I'd have to fight hard to be able to get time in the president's schedule. Believe it or not, a presidential staff always thinks there's something else that the president ought to do, and they're never too friendly to a suggestion from the Vice President. But I had a working relationship with President Johnson that permitted me to go over the top, so to speak, of some of the presidential staff, and to speak directly to him about the importance of a meeting with the executive board of the National Association of County Officials, or with the top leadership of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Then too, I thought it was important for these local officials to be brought into other matters besides just the programs that related to localities and to the cities and counties. I saw to it that the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense could talk to them about national security and foreign policy. After all, who is closer to the people, who sees more people, who speaks to more people than mayors and county commissioners and state legislators and council members? And these people were brought into the State Department. It was quite an exciting experience for many of them. After all, to be brought into the East Room of the White House and to meet the President is an experience that a man or a woman will remember all of his or her life. To be brought into the State Department on the 8th floor in the big meeting rooms, to see the desk of Thomas Jefferson, to see the historic memorabilia that is there from the early days of the American Republic, to meet with the Secretary of State and the Undersecretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, and to listen to them outline the foreign policy and the national security policy of the United States, is a is a very rich and exciting experience for anyone. And I know that hundreds of mayors and local government officials profited from that. Likewise, so did the administration, because this way the administration was able to get its story directly to the local officials rather than being filtered through the press or the media. So my work as vice president in contact with in contacting local officials was one of the most refreshing and rewarding experiences of my public life. But I want to say that it needs to be formalized, that every vice president should do this, or at least someone that's close to the president, because local governmental officials need to be in closer contact with their president and their Congress. They need to be in close contact with the secretaries of their respective departments. These secretaries are not too busy for that kind of work. They just think they are. They spend a lot of time talking to people that are much less important. And they'll learn a great deal if they spend some time with the local officials. Local officials know what goes on. They know the weaknesses and the strengths of a program. They have to carry out those programs at the local level. They are out there on the firing line. They're the ones that meet the people rather than just meet the press. And I would strongly suggest that if our government is to do its job as it ought to at the federal level, that it must do a much better job of working closely with the local government, state and local government officials. Governors, to be sure, very important. But legislators and legislative leaders, cabinet officers ought to get out and speak to the state legislatures. They ought to meet with legislative committees that are responsible for the state aspect of a particular program where a federal grant or a federal legislation has been adopted or has been enacted. They ought to meet, these secretaries and cabinet officers ought to be meeting with mayors and county officials. They ought to bring them closer into closer contact and closer communication, and to learn what really goes on out where the programs are applied. It's one thing to design a program in Washington. It's another thing to make it effective in the hometown and out in the county and township levels of government. All too often, Washington officials, from the president on down, failed to get the information back as to what's really going on out where the programs are applied. Programs are not good because they seem to appeal to an editorial writer or make good copy in the leading press. Programs are effective only if they do the job for which they were designed, with the people. And who knows the people? The people, the public officials that are closest to the people. To be sure, congressmen know a good deal, but congressmen themselves can learn much. And those that are good congressmen do learn much and stay in close contact with, do learn much from and stay in close contact with the local government officials. This is what we mean by a healthy federalism. Federalism is not a chart. It is not a dissertation on American government. Federalism is a working partnership, a working relationship, very personal human relationship between people at the national, state, and local governmental levels, all who understand that they have but one objective, and that is to serve the people. Norman, here's just a little tidbit. One of the nicer things that President Johnson did during his presidency was to see to it that the former president, Harry Truman, received proper attention and respect. President Truman was failing in health in those years of the 1960s, and President Johnson heard about it and took the liberty of sending a message to President Truman that President Johnson wanted President Truman to take a vacation and to go back down to Key West, Florida, where President Truman had vacationed during his time as president, where Mr. Truman had vacationed during his presidency. President Johnson sent out to Independence, Missouri, a Dr. Voss, who was to check on the health of President Truman, and to encourage the former president to take the time to go down into the Southland and get some sunshine and rest. The president made available a government plane, and Harry Truman went to his favorite vacation spot, and he and Mrs. Truman spent several weeks at Key West with Dr. Voss in attendance, and President Truman came alive again. His health was restored. This was just a little act of consideration and kindness on the part of President Johnson, which I think went unnoticed during those difficult days, but it demonstrated that this unique man, Lyndon Johnson, was a man of sentiment as well as a man of power. Our little Vicky, our mentally retarded granddaughter, came down to Washington during the time that I was vice president to visit with Muriel and to visit with her grandfather and grandmother. She was there over Valentine's Day. Come to Washington at the invitation of the Advertising Council to do some television spots for the National Association for the... Well, Lady Bird Johnson was kind enough to invite Vicky and Muriel and Vicky and myself to come over and have lunch at the White House. And she said to come a little early and maybe we could go in and see the president. Vicky could go in and see the president. So Grandmother Humphrey fixed up a box of nice cookies in a Valentine's box for Vicky to present to the president, because the president really liked some of these cookies that we were getting from North Carolina. He had been to our apartment and had found these homemade ginger cookies and just enjoyed them immensely. I might add that Lady Bird was worried that the president was going to eat too many, because they were rather sweet and he was on a rigid diet. But be that as it may, we went on over to the White House, and here was our little Vicky, dressed in a lovely white dress, trimmed in red, really in a Valentine in Valentine colors. And she had this beautifully heart-shaped box filled with these ginger cookies that the president loved so much. And she stood there alongside of President Johnson. You just have to imagine this scene. This towering, strong man, 6 foot 4 inches tall, and our little Vicky, then about 8 years of age, presenting this box, this heart-shaped box of cookies, to the president. It was a sight to behold, and a very sentimental one. And she just spoke right up and said to the president, "Mr. President, I have some cookies for you." And she handed them, and of course photographs were taken, photographs that we treasure to this very day. And then the president gave her a big hug and squeeze and took some time to talk with her. We left the Oval Room of the White House and went to the second floor for the family quarters for lunch. We went into that private dining room, and there was Lady Bird Johnson, Muriel, myself, and we were waiting for the president. While we were sitting there waiting for the president, the waiter came by, and he very politely said to Vicky, "Now, Miss Vicky, what would you like to have for lunch?" Of course, the luncheon menu had already been arranged, and he was just being very courteous and considerate of Vicky. And that sweet little granddaughter of ours looked up with her pretty little eyes, and she said to this big waiter, this gentleman waiter, she said, "I want a peated butter and jelly sandwich." Her speech was not always so plain, but she surely knew how to say peanut butter, and rather than saying jelly, she said jetty. She wanted a peanut butter and grape jetty sandwich. Well, this brought consternation to the White House Culinary Department. They had everything. She could have ordered pheasant or duck or turkey. She could have ordered venison or beef or pork chops. She could have ordered a souffle or whatever else she might have thought of. But peanut butter and jelly, that was something else. But I'm happy to say that the waiter was able to go down to what is known as the Navy Mess, which is in the basement of the White House, where many of the staff and clerks and secretaries eat, and he was able to come up with some peanut butter and jelly, and our little Vicky had her peanut butter and jetty sandwich, and with President and Mrs. Johnson in the White House. Not bad for a little girl that was mentally retarded, but who brought a message of love and a message of faith to the president and his lady and to all of the country. Now, Norman, here's a second little anecdote that we can put in about children, and that's about our granddaughter, Lori. Lori is the daughter of our oldest son, Hubert H. Humphrey III, and his wife, Nancy Lee. Well, Lori's grandfather, on her mother's side, is a Navy captain, and he had taught our little Lori a good deal about American patriotism, and particularly the flag. So Lori, at a very tender age of around 3 years of age or so, was a flag-waving patriot. She went to a birthday party one day. Oh, she'd always been taught that when she sees the flag, to stand at attention and to salute. That was her maternal grandfather's way of impressing on Lori the meaning of patriotism. Well, Lori was at a birthday party, and she had to go to the potty. So she was told she was taken into a little side room where there was a toilet, but the wallpaper was filled with pictures of America and of flags. And as Lori was sitting there on the potty, hanging on for dear life, lest she fall in, she looked up, and lo and behold, she saw a flag right in front of her. And trained as she was by her maternal grandfather, she let loose of the seat, of the toilet seat, put her hand up to her brow, saluted the flag, and proceeded to fall forthwith into the potty. Now that's the true acid test of patriotism. Grandchildren are a delight, and sometimes they can even be sometimes they can be full of mischief. One day I was visiting with our daughter, Nancy's youngest daughter, Cindy. And Cindy is a pixie if there ever was one. Well, she has three older sisters, and sometimes it's rather difficult for Cindy to get the attention that she thinks she justly deserves. On this particular occasion, Cindy came to me and tugged at my coat and said, "Grandpa, what's your name?" And I said, "Well, now, Cindy, you know Grandpa's name. Why do you ask a foolish question like that?" She says, "Grandpa, I want you to tell me your name, your full name." And I said to her, "Well, my name is Hubert Horatio Humphrey, Miss Cindy. Now, how do you like that for a name?" And she looked at me and she laughed out loud and she says, "That's a funny name. That Horatio is a real funny name, Grandpa." And of course, now she is getting the attention that she wants. So I proceeded to tell her that Horatio was a very good name. And I said, "Now, Cindy, I want you to know that Horatio is a very important name in history. I said there was an old Roman by the name of Horatio, and he was a soldier. He was a very brave man. And he helped take care of the great country and city of Rome. There's a story that there were some very bad people trying to come in and take over Rome and capture it. And there was a bridge across the river and the bad people were coming on one side of the bridge, and only Horatio stood on the other side. And as the bad people came across the bridge, Horatio pushed them into the water or beat them back with his sword. And as a result of this great heroic act, this brave and courageous act on the part of Horatio, why, the people of Rome were very proud of him. And they said that Horatio was the finest Roman of them all. And then our little Cindy looked up at me and she said, "But Grandpa, you're not a Roman, you're a Democrat." Such is the wisdom and the tricks of a very alert and gregarious granddaughter. Public life is filled with so many uncertainties and unpredictables. Frankly, I find that the things that you plan on seldom work out, as well as the things that just seem to happen. It's often been said that the most important thing in both athletics, in athletics and politics, is preparation and timing. You can prepare and prepare, but if the timing isn't right, things just don't work out. Well, one of those unpredictable instances that lives in my memory is an occasion when I was in New York City to deliver a speech. I had some time during the day before the evening speech, so I decided to take a walk around as I was saying, I had some time on my hands, so I decided to take a walk around Wall Street and take a look at some of the historic sites there, the old Treasury Building, Trinity Church, and to visit the Stock Exchange. I'd never been in the Stock Exchange, even though I'd, of course, read a great deal about it, and I thought it was time that I should become acquainted with it. The stock market was in a serious drop. It was in 1961. People were very worried over the developments in the market. I was surely no expert on stocks and bonds and market practices. But as a United States Senator and now as the Majority Whip of the Senate, I thought it would be well for me to at least try to find out something about the stock market operation. I walked into the Stock Exchange building and asked the guard where was the office of Mr. Keith Funston, the president of the Stock Exchange. As I recall, he told me it was on the sixth floor. So I got on the elevator and proceeded up to the sixth floor and entered the reception room. I spoke to the receptionist and identified myself and said that I was just stopping by to pay my respects to Mr. Keith Funston, and if he had a moment, I surely would appreciate the opportunity of meeting him. The receptionist referred me to Mr. Funston's secretary, who in turn told me that Mr. Funston was temporarily in a meeting, but that she would take a message to him. Well, it should be remembered that Mr. Funston's a very busy man, and I had not called for any appointment. In fact, my visit was really a rather impulsive one. As I stood there waiting for the secretary to approach Mr. Funston about my presence, thoughts flashed through my mind about my kind of politics from the Midwest, liberal, democratic farmer labor politics, and Mr. Keith Funston, who was the president of the New York Stock Exchange. I couldn't help but think that here was a liberal Democrat standing in the New York Stock Exchange, in the citadel of corporate power, money, and Republican conservatism. In other words, the stereotypes were there and were at that particular moment flashing through my mind. Just about that time, the secretary came back and said that Mr. Funston would be pleased to see me. And she escorted and she took me into his office. It was not particularly an ostentatious richly appointed office. It was a businessman's office, and there was this gentleman, Mr. Funston, sitting behind his desk. He was a rather slim, tall man, with clear, sharp eyes, and a rather long and lean figure, long and lean face that typified the kind of sharp trader, T-R-A-D-E-R, and businessman that you would expect to see in the, that you would have been led to believe, that you would expect to see, according to all of the stereotype descriptions of the stock market, in that particular position. We sort of looked at each other for a while. I simply said hello, told him who I was, said that I'd merely stopped by to say hello, and wanted to and appreciated the fact that he'd give me a few minutes of his time. He looked at me and said, "You're the senator from Minnesota," and I said, "That's correct." And he said, "You know, I believe you were born in South Dakota, isn't that right?" At which point I said, "Yes." I said, "I was born in Wallace, South Dakota, but I later on, as a little boy, went to Dolan, South Dakota with my mother and father, went through elementary and high school in Dolan, and subsequently moved to Huron, South Dakota, which was a considerably larger town. After all, Wallace was about 100 people, Dolan 600, and Huron about 10,000. Mr. Funston listened to me give this brief account of my life, and then he said, "Well," he said, "I'm very pleased to hear about your South Dakota experience." He said, "You know, I come from Ramona, South Dakota." And I looked at him in amazement, and I said, "Ramona? Why," I said, "Doland is a metropolitan area compared to Ramona." And he said, "Well," he said, "that's true." He said, "We're both small town boys from South Dakota." He said, "My father was the banker at Ramona, South Dakota." And I said, "Well, my father was the druggist at Huron, at Dolan, South Dakota." And then we started to visit about our experiences in South Dakota as young men. Well, strange. Recalling the Depression, recalling the troubles of the banks and the farms and the farmers. And as if by magic, there was some kind of mutual identity, a common, at least some common ground. Yet I'm sure that that Keith Funston must have felt just as I did. Looking at me, he undoubtedly saw in my countenance and physical presence that wild-eyed radicalism and socialism that had been so often ascribed to people of my kind of political persuasion. And I, looking at him, couldn't help but feel what here is Mr. Conservative himself, Mr. Stock Market, Mr. Gambler, a man identified with many of the evils of our society, such are the stereotypes that are fixed upon us. And in a very few moments I found out, the both of us found out, that we were talking to fellow human beings that had had some common experiences, and both of us possessing deep concern about what was happening in our country. It was almost an instant friendship. We spent better than an hour that day, better than 2 hours that day, talking to each other. Keith Funston took me to the floor of the stock market. I'd never been there before. He explained to me how the trading that was taking place there. He introduced me to a number of his to the number of the stock exchange members, and he asked me to return and come to talk with their board of governors, an invitation which I readily accepted. This experience is one that in many ways had a very profound and deep effect upon me. I began to understand for the first time something about the stock market. I began to appreciate some of the problems that the president of the stock market faced. And I recall at that particular moment he was deeply concerned about an investigation that was underway in this United States, an investigation of the market that was underway in the Senate. He asked me what I thought would happen. And I said to Mr. Funston, I said to Keith Funston, look, why do you wait for the Congress to investigate you? You here as president of the stock exchange, and the members of the board of governors and the members of this stock exchange have more at stake in an honest and reliable stock market than any member of Congress has. To be sure, Congress has the responsibility under the Securities Exchange Act to monitor what goes on here and to also to monitor the work of the Securities Exchange Commission. Congress also has the responsibility to see whether or not the laws that we have passed are effective and doing what they were intended to do. But you in the stock exchange have a greater responsibility. It's to your benefit to see that this market is operated honestly and openly, without abuse or any form or taint of corruption. Why don't you, therefore, set up your own investigating committee? Why don't you set up your own study commission and investigating committee and come to the Congress with your own suggestions and your own report? Well, to make a long story short, Mr. Funston took this proposal up with his board of governors, and it was accepted. And a blue ribbon committee of highly respected people in the financial and business community was established to look into the practices of the market. A prolonged study and investigation was made by this private committee, and the report was prepared. Later on, Mr. Funston came to Washington, D.C. with his report in hand, and I took him to the appropriate members of the Senate who were interested in the stock exchange legislation, who were interested in legislation pertaining to the stock exchange. Mr. Funston testified before the Senate Committee on Commerce, that had jurisdiction over the stock exchange. He brought with him his own report of this special commission that he had established. And as a result, there was a meeting of the minds between the legislators and Mr. Funston and his associates. And the stock exchange was the better for it, and the Congress was reassured as to the propriety and the responsibility of the stock exchange and its and those that governed it and administered it. I believe that this was a classic example of how private industry and government can work together if they will work together in trust and in openness. But to go back to Keith Funston again, this was the beginning of a very warm friendship. And later on, when I was seeking public office as Vice President of the United States, I went to the New York Stock Exchange and was permitted to speak to the entire membership. This is the first time that any politician had to speak to all of the personnel on the stock exchange floor. In fact, they closed down the exchange for those few minutes as I addressed the entire audience and the entire membership, clerks and traders and others, from the balcony of the exchange. What a remarkable experience it was. and I was introduced by none other than Mr. Republican himself, Keith Funston. But he introduced me as one who had shown an interest in the stock exchange and have been of some help. Later on, when I was a candidate for president in 1968, I was likewise brought into the stock exchange. And Mrs. Muriel and I visited the stock exchange together. She was one of the first women to ever set foot within the exchange. It had been really a male operation, and to put it quite frankly, male chauvinism at its best. But Muriel and I were taken around and introduced to many of the different officials and traders and market operators. And I again was permitted to address the Board of Governors and to sit down and have lunch with them and talk to them about national policies and the developments in our economy. Keith Funston became my friend, or should I put it this, and I was privileged to share in his friendship. I found him to be a very decent and constructive and responsible man. Our political views on all subjects did not always agree in our political views. Obviously, we did not. He was a Republican, I was a Democrat. But we found that we could trust each other, and we found that we could work together in some areas in complete confidence and trust. And I have found that this to be true in so many experiences in my public life. All too often, those of us who seem to be in confrontation keep apart. We are separated by not only distance of thought and philosophy, but actually distance of time and space. If we would only take more time to see each other face to face, to sit together, to talk together, and see if we cannot find some area of agreement. We expect this of business and labor. We expect it in collective bargaining. We insist upon it. But all too often in politics, we specialize not in cooperation and in coordination, but in confrontation and opposition. I know that the confrontation makes news, but I also know that sitting down as reasonable people, talking out our differences, or at least openly expressing them and trying to find some common ground for agreement, is the way that you build a country, an organization, or the way that you build a company, a union, an organization, or a country. I prefer to work together with people rather than to indulge in the excesses of controversy and confrontation simply for the news value and for the publicity that it brings. In the campaign of 1968, I took my election campaign right into the Wall Street district. I spoke from the steps of the old U.S. Treasury building, and out of the stock exchange out of those banking houses and stock exchange poured hundreds and thousands of people to listen to my message. I was given a very respectful audience, and frankly, a considerable enthusiastic support. I spoke to them honestly of my views about the economy and about the course that America should follow. And I'm pleased to say that my views were listened to, and I felt that I was getting through with my message. Keith Funston helped me in that. I shall never forget him. He's a good man, and he has served his country well and faithfully, and he served those for whom he had responsibility in the stock market with brilliance and competence. During my term as vice president, I was privileged to meet with a large with a number of business executives and corporate managers. I always had a good working relationship with the labor movement of America, and continued that all during my years of public service. I have found the American labor movement to be a very constructive and positive force for in our nation. But my contacts with business had been rather limited. To be sure, back home in Minnesota, I got along very well with our business leaders. Many of them had turned to me for help, in particular when they were in some difficulty or when they needed some special service. As mayor of the city of Minneapolis after my first term, I had considerable business support. In other words, I believe that many of the business people, while not agreeing with me politically, did trust me and knew that I was deeply concerned, deeply interested in our community and our state. I have no complaints about Minnesota business. To the contrary, I find the businessmen of our state to be forward-looking, open, and willing to be willing to talk with you and to listen to you. My relationships with the Minnesota business community in the main have been very good and healthy. But on the national scene, I was of course portrayed not as a friend of business, but rather as one who was anti-business and pro-labor. The large organizations such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, had me labeled as anything but a friend to business, and most of the time, as they would put it, anti-business. Their checklist of legislation showed me voting most of the time against the policy that the U.S. Chamber or the NAM wanted. Therefore, during the time that I was vice president, President Johnson asked me to broaden my acquaintanceship with the business and economic community. And he helped me in this manner, in this endeavor. When meetings were held at the White House, where businessmen were included, and many such were held, I was invited in. I sat in on all of the business meetings, all of the meetings with the business executives at the time that we were trying to reduce our balance of payments deficit. President Johnson worked very closely with the business leaders in all matters relating to the economy. To his everlasting credit, I doubt that he ever took an initiative that affected the nation's economy but what he had consulted with not just a few, but with many of the leading business figures in American economic, in American financial, industrial, and commercial life. I was asked as vice president to speak before many of these groups. Many times a business group would want to hear the administration point of view. And since I was more or less the official spokesman for the administration, and a vice president who does have the time for that sort of thing, I would go and represent the policies of the administration. This gave me an opportunity not only to speak openly about the policies of the Johnson administration, but also to become acquainted, but also to listen to the comments of those who were at the meeting, to have private conferences and consultation with a number of the leading figures in American economic life. Period. One of the men that I met that became a close and dear friend was Mr. Malcolm Forbes, the editor and publisher of the Forbes magazine. The Forbes magazine is one of the most prestigious and respected publications that go to that deal with our that go to the business that goes to the business community. Malcolm Forbes is an individualist. He is a free enterpriser. He is a most unusual man. He has a wide variety of interests, everything from sailing in balloons to his views upon the most controversial pieces of legislation, of federal legislation. He had been in New Jersey politics. He had run for governor of the state of New Jersey. He was a card-carrying Republican. But for some reason or another, we hit it off. I liked him, and apparently he liked me. I spoke to his board of editors. I was privileged to write an article for his magazine. And from time to time, when he would come to Washington, he would come by and pay me a visit. And I would do the same when I went to New Jersey or to New York. Well, lo and behold, one day I received a call from Malcolm Forbes saying that he wanted to give me a party, that he was going to invite in all of the top advertisers, all of the top corporation executives of those corporations that advertised in his magazine and others. He said, in other words, Hubert, the captains of American industry will be here. All of the nation's capitalists will be here. And I want them to see you, and I want you to speak to them. It'll be good for them, and it won't hurt you. He told me, he said, I'm going to put on a party that you'll remember the rest of your life. And believe me, he did just that. Malcolm Forbes is not a man that exaggerates. He lays it on the line, and he produces what he promises. I arrived at the Forbes home, a magnificent home at, we got to get the place there now, in New Jersey. I was, and arrived early enough to be able to rest a while, change my clothes, and prepare for what was to be an unforgettable evening. The party start. The home was decorated like an old Scottish castle. He had brought in decorators that had created a scene as if we were in the Highlands of Scotland. There was a tent that was as an addition to the Forbes beautiful home, and all of the. And the structure, as you looked at the structure from the outside, you would swear that you were in Scotland and that you were looking at some castle in Glasgow or Edinburgh. And then at the proper hour of the evening, just before sunset, over the hills came six Scottish bagpipe bands, as if they were leading a charge up the hill. This was just to announce to the guests that the party was underway. And then the festivities started with a dinner that was worthy of the tradition of Louis the 14th or of contemporary European royalty, with champagne and wines, with entertainment and music, with dancing. Everything that you could possibly conjure up to make an evening enjoyable, Malcolm Forbes had it. And then, lo and behold, at the hour of 12 midnight, he got up before the guests, who by this time were of high spirit due to the consumption of a substantial amount of spirits, and said, "I'm going to ask the Vice President of the United States to speak to you." Now, if ever I had an assignment that challenged me, it was this one. How do you speak to several hundred guests? How do you speak to several hundred guests who have already had a sumptuous dinner, who have consumed champagne and wine and other liquors, who have been dancing and have had entertainment? How do you stop the show, put on a speaker, and hope to and have the speaker hope to even gain their attention, much less their understanding. Well, this is what separates the men from the boys, and I suppose in a very real and immodest sense, the professionals from the amateurs. I had to respond. It was understood when I was invited there that I was going to say some word, that I was going to speak to these guests. But I thought it would be either before the dinner or immediately after the main course, not after they'd had the champagne, the wine, the scotch and soda, the bourbon and branch water, the dancing, the music, and the entertainment. But I was not in charge of the program, as I found out. Malcolm Forbes was. So I spoke. And lo and behold, I was able to hold the audience. I didn't speak too long. This time I knew that length was disastrous, that brevity was going to be precious and important. But I did speak to them, and some of them, and used a good deal of good humor that seemed to tide me over. I think that's it. One story that I told, I opened my remarks by saying that President Johnson had told me there were at least three places that a man ought never to make a speech. One was at a cocktail party. Another was at a Texas barbecue, and the third was at a rodeo. And I said I was going to add a fourth: never make a speech at midnight at Malcolm Forbes' party, particularly if you're a Democrat in a household filled with Republicans and corporation presidents. I then went on to describe to them how a vice president gets along with the president. Because I said many of you tonight have asked me, just how do you get along with President Johnson? I told him it wasn't too difficult, but there was a formula. And the formula had been laid down by none other than the great English statesman Disraeli. Disraeli explained his successes, or his success with Queen Victoria. He said, "I never refuse, I never contradict, I sometimes forget." And I said, that has worked beautifully for me. If you just remember who's the boss. I never refuse, I never contradict, I sometimes forget. Now there are times, however, when I have violated these precepts, only to find myself excommunicated for a period of time from the consuls of the White House, no longer getting free lunches or being invited to the festive board of the festive board of the Johnson family. But I said, one good thing about President Johnson is that he has a capacity to forgive, even if he doesn't forget. And there were times when he would forgive me, even if my transgressions were of major significance. I then went on to explain to the audience in humorous vein the difference between the presidency and the vice presidency. I said the best way to understand this is to look at the presidential seal and then at the vice presidential seal. I said, now in the presidential seal, you see the great American eagle. He looks strong and healthy, his wings unfurled, his head erect, and his sharp eyes, feathers literally glistening with vitality and beauty. And in the talons of one leg, he carries a sheath of arrows. And in the other, in the talons of the other, he carries the olive branch. This is the great seal of the President of the United States, the bold American eagle in full flight, strong, vital, powerful, and yet the emblem, powerful, the emblem of strength and of peace, of direction and of leadership. Now I said, take a look at the emblem of the vice president. What is it? What do you see? You see that same American eagle, but he looks like he's just gotten over a case of virus flu. His head is drooped, his wings are downcast, his feathers look ruffled and unkept. And then look at those legs of his. in the talons of one leg he has but one, but one little olive branch.
And the
president ought to be vice president at least once. It will give him a sense of humility which he will never forget. And it will also teach him that important lesson in government, how to have responsibility without authority. Because believe me, the vice presidential office is loaded with responsibility. But whatever authority it has is only a grant from the president himself. I always used to say that there was what we call Humphrey's Law, that he who giveth can taketh away. And the vice president is so devoid of staff and authority under law and constitution that most all powers that he has are those that are granted to him by the president. And whatever staff he has are those that, with few exceptions, are those that are made available by the president out of the executive departments. Therefore, whenever a vice president steps out of line, he not only loses what authority he might be temporarily exercising, but he is stripped naked of staff and personnel. Woe is he in the vice presidency who incurs the wrath of a president. Better that he should be a humble citizen than to occupy that office and be in disfavor in high places. Let me just amend my story on the eagles. The president's eagle looks like he is ready to take off into the skies and into new horizons. The vice presidential eagle, it looks like he is gliding in for a crash landing. Politics is a... Politics and public office are not just hard work, campaigning, elections, and responsibility. They're also politics and public office also carry with them good times, the privilege to know wonderful and wonderfully interesting people, and from time to time, memorable occasions that live with you for years. One of those occasions was the party that was given Muriel and myself by James Ford Bell, Jr. of Wayzata, Minnesota. Ford Bell was the son of James Bell, the great industrialist of Minneapolis, a rock-ribbed conservative Republican, and president of General Mills. The Bell family is highly regarded and well-respected in our community, but the family has never been known for its leaning towards the Democratic Party. But Ford Bell was the maverick, a man of independent means, to be sure, but also of independent decision and attitude. In many ways, he was the different one in that amazing family. And I got to know him through a mutual friend, Miles Lord, former Attorney General of Minnesota, former United States District Attorney, and presently Federal District Judge of the U.S. District Court in Minnesota. Miles Lord and Ford Bell were two of the most interesting and unique characters that I've ever known. They enjoyed each other's company and enjoyed ribbing each other unmercifully. I was brought into this fellowship because of our friendship with Miles and his wife Maxine. So from time to time, I would see Ford Bell when I was home. Miles Lord would bring us together for lunch. We'd talk a little politics. Ford had his own point of view. You couldn't classify it as a Democratic point of view or a Republican point of view. It was just Ford Bell's point of view. He knew everybody in the social circles of the Twin Cities. There are a number of our people who are of means and of wealth and high position that live out around what we call Lake Minnetonka, Wayzata, Orono, Ferndale area. Yes, it's the Minneapolis suburb where the well-to-do, where many of the well-to-do live. And here's where Ford Bell lived, in a beautiful home that might well qualify as a mansion. I had visited that home on a number of occasions and had the opportunity to know Ford and his wife and family. Later on, when I had the chance to invite guests to Washington to a White House dinner, I invited Ford and his wife. And I remember on one occasion after the dinner at the White House, the dinner and party at the White House, Ford said to me, "I want to give you a party that will make this one at the White House look like a country clam bake. What you need is something that is high class. And if you'll give me a date, I'll put on a party out at my home that you will remember for the rest of your life. And I'll have you and Muriel there to meet all of my Republican neighbors. I want them to meet you, and I want them to tell you how much they like you, because most of them are going to lie to you, and I want to be there and hear it. So we're going to have a party, Hubert, if you'll just say the word." Well, I gave the word, and some months later, Ford and his wife invited a number of guests to their beautiful home for an evening with Vice President and Mrs. Humphrey. It was a gala occasion. Ford had brought in two orchestras. He had decorated his home like it was a magnificent cabaret. He had brought in decorators from New York to carry out the motif that he wanted. And then came the evening of the party, and his guests arrived. Ford and Mrs. Bell, Muriel and myself stood in line. And as the guests came in, Ford would present them to me. Many of them I already knew. But he would introduce them to me and say, "Now, here is Mr. So-and-so, and I want you to know, Hubert, he's a good Republican. He's never said a kind word about you, and he's never contributed a dollar to you, to your campaign. But I thought he ought to come over here and say hello to you and greet you and treat you with respect. So I've invited him." And so the evening went on. From time to time, somebody would come by and say, "Hubert, we think you're doing a good, or Mr. Vice President, we think you're doing a good job. I want to wish you the very best." At which point, Ford would interrupt and say he doesn't mean it at all. He doesn't think you're doing a good job, and he never has wished you the best. But I just wanted him to see you, and I want him to come on over here and literally bow down and pay his respects to you as Vice President of the United States. Now, Ford is known as a rather maverick, is known as a maverick in his community, and you might call him just a character. But the point is that he knew everybody, and he had a social standing so that no one was going to refuse his invitation. And he enjoys being blatantly blunt. And as these fine citizens, fine neighbors would come by, he would identify them to me and to Muriel, not only by name, but also by party affiliation, whether they had said anything kindly about us, or whether they had been opposed to us, whether they had made a contribution to my campaign, or whether they had spent their resources trying to get me defeated. It was one of the most unbelievable evenings of my life. But despite all of it, everybody seemed to understand Ford Bell and how he operated. So we had the time of our life. We were dancing. There was a delicious and marvelous dinner. There was music, the best that could be provided. And there was dancing and cocktails and friendship and fellowship until the wee hours of the morning. So despite Ford Bell's eccentricities, no man or no couple ever was more hospitable and gracious. No couple more generous than the Bells to the Humphreys and their guests that evening. These are the kind of occasions that can come to one in public life. This is one of many, but one that I recall so well. And even to this very day, I enjoy the company of Ford Bell. He's unusual. He's eccentric. He does things his own way. He surely is his own man. But he's the kind of a person that makes public life just a little bit more enjoyable. He doesn't spend his time agreeing with you or fawning over you. He's an independent, and he is perfectly willing to speak his piece, whether you like it or not. But when the chips are down, as they say, he's there to be of help, and that he has for these many years in my public life. But one has many friends in politics, and some are more dear to you than others. One of the great difficulties in public life is to find time for your friends. And of course, one of the great gifts of public life is the fact that your friends are willing to be so tolerant with you. It's so easy at times to offend, even though it is unintentional. A man or woman in public life is generally under a very strict schedule and frequently in a hurry. Local friends or personal friends sometimes don't quite understand that, but the good ones, the dear ones, the true ones do, and they suffer through a great deal with you. Well, two of our dearest friends were Duane and Ines Andreas. They have helped us so much and been so kind and so charitable and so generous over the years. Their son, Michael Andreas, is my godson. Their son Michael and our youngest son, Douglas, were very close personal friends in their youth. Duane and Ines had a lovely home out at Lake Minnetonka, and many was the evening that we joined them for dinner and to be with them and their friends and ours. They also had a lovely apartment in Bell Harbor, Miami, Florida. And from the earliest days of our association, we would go visit with them and spend a weekend or a lot of time with